Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Robbie Suave. Robbie, did I pronounce that correctly?
Yep, that's right.
Thank you. Okay. He is associate editor at Reason Magazine, reason.com. He has also, in fact, built a pretty strong reputation in the journalism world as an investigative reporter, something of an important watchdog figure in the profession. He's written stories for New York Times, CNN, USA Today, etc., apart from his work with Reason, and he's often seen on major television and radio shows. Robbie, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Well, now the reason why I pulled you on is because I've seen some things that you'd written, and I noticed you have a book coming out in June, and I want to tell our listeners it's entitled Panic Attack: Young Radicals in the Age of Trump. And you can pre-order it on Amazon right now. That'll be our main topic for today. It'll be out in a couple months, but I wanted to go ahead and have you on and talk about things, especially given what's happened in the last few days. And before we get to the book, I thought that I would like to ask you about the Covington Catholic affair, where actually we had we had at what at first seemed like young, maybe slightly out of control or mocking and cruel young people, but didn't turn out to be the case. You wrote one of the first and I think best assessments of the whole thing not long after the full video came out. And I wonder if you could just take our listeners through your experience of the whole affair, your first exposure to it, and the process of you examining things and coming out with a new assessment that did, you know, go spread very widely on Twitter early on and was picked up by a lot of journalists.
Absolutely. You know, over the weekend, last weekend, when the initial very short footage was spreading like wildfire on social media, I was at a conference and I wasn't even paying a lot of attention to social media. So I picked it up, you know, after it was already, everywhere. And I said, well, that looks, but I didn't look very closely at it. I said, that looks bad. And I thought, you know, tomorrow I'll write something about it. I'll write something about how, you know, we need to instruct young people to how to become adults and that sort of thing.
This is sort of your beat with
right,
the book
right.
and other things you've written.
Right. I'm very interested in students and young people and the cultural issues surrounding them, how we socialize them into kind of polite society. So the next day I woke up and I started seeing, you know, very scattered kind of pushback, like, oh, there's much more video now available. So I said, all right, well, I should really watch all this before I weigh in. And then, you know, I started watching the longer video, and actually there's 2 hours of footage, much of it taking place before the encounter between the boys and the Native American man, Nathan Phillips. And the more I was watching this, the more I realized that the everything people had said about this was completely backward, that in fact there is this group of a couple members of the Hebrew the Black Hebrew Israelites, which now everyone's kind of talking about them. I've encountered them on the streets of DC before.
You
probably have as well. They set up shop near the Gallery Place metro station all the time, and they're an insane fringe group. They are shouting at these boys that racial slurs. They're making the homophobic slurs, bigoted statements. They called them pedophiles and incest babies. I mean, these are nasty, nasty people with kooky fringe beliefs like the Nation of Islam or the Westboro Baptist Church or something like that. And the boys are not. They're hearing this and they're responding within a range of behavior that seems pretty normal to me. Sometimes they laugh, sometimes they boo them when they say something offensive, sometimes they're just ignoring them, and then towards the end they start to do like pep rally cheers, sports cheers to kind of drown them out.
And how long did that portion go on?
this video footage is from the Black Hebrew Israelites perspective. So there we're at an hour and 10 minutes now before Nathan Phillips even arrives on scene. And there, and again, the way the media has written about this has been so dishonest. I've seen people say, well, look, this one kid took off his shirt to mock Nathan Phillips. No, the guy took off his shirt. Nathan Phillips wasn't even there when that happened. If he's mocking someone, he's mocking these the totally insane group of cult people.
And the Black Israelites, didn't they get bored after 20 minutes? You would think they'd run out of gas, but no.
Well, this is their thing, right? They're trying to poke and prod you. They're trying to get a rise out of you. They actually dare. They challenge the kids to fight them. They said, "Oh, you know, that you're wimps. You're afraid of us. You outnumber us. You're not going to come fight us." They were trying to start something, and the kids, I mean, they didn't do nothing. If your perspective is they should have just totally ignored them, sure, that's fine. I get that. They didn't totally ignore them, but they didn't start a fight with them either. And then Nathan Phillips shows up, and he totally misreads the situation. He decides that the white teenagers are the bad guys, and this cult. Are the good guys or the vulnerable people, even though they've been the ones, you know, hurling insults and slurs and challenges to violence for the last hour. Nathan Phillips goes up to disrupt what the boys are doing with his drumming and his singing. And then that's, of course, when the moment we saw happened. But given every and of course, you know, it's true that some of the boys, a few of them, not a lot of them, just I count two or three who do this sort of tomahawk motion.
Right.
Most of the boys are just jumping and sort of raising their arms in like a raise the volume or the sort of like a pep rally thing, which is what they were doing before he was even there. So it has nothing to do with him. He is invading their moment. So everyone is like, well, they should have, I don't know, they should have immediately fallen quiet and solemnly, you know, listen to what he was doing, I guess. But they just had no idea what he was there for. And in fact, he was there with bad intentions, thinking they were the bad guys.
You know, in some of the follow-ups after the video, the fuller video has gone out, your corrections have gone out, people have really come back to the tomahawk motion and tried to turn it into a much more deliberate and intense, universal kind of collective insult. And I want to think, boy, are you guys stretching.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So You watch this.
And the kid they focused on, he didn't do it. Nick Sandman, the guy, he didn't do anything but smile.
Right. You know, the picture, I'm on the webpage with your first at reason.com with your first correction where you said the media wildly mischaracterized that video of Covington Catholic students confronting a Native American veteran. And you show the two figures paired off in profile. The drum is right in between them. Phillips is hitting the drum. The Sandman kid is sort of kind of looking almost glum, staring. And what I see is, who are you? What are you doing? This is a strange situation. What Mr. Phillips is doing, he's the one yelling. He's the one chanting. I don't want to start reading into one photograph. We know how seductive that can be. You watch the whole video. You put this together. You say, far from engaging in racially motivated harassment, the group of mostly white, MAGA hat wearing male teenagers remain relatively calm and restrained despite being subjected to incessant racist, homophobic, and bigoted verbal abuse by members of the bizarre religious sect Black Hebrew Israelites who were lurking nearby. So you compose the post. You put it up. Did you get a big response from that?
Yeah, huge response. It is the most well-read article I've ever written. It's had over a million and a half, I think, page views online right now. I've had a few other big stories, but this is the biggest, definitely. And it was well received to some degree in the media. Jake Tapper tweeted it. Meghan McCain talked about it on The View. Who's someone I know personally, but she has a large audience, obviously. And a lot of people in the media, you know, corrected themselves. I think conservatives, many of whom who had been very eager to disassociate themselves from the bad behavior of these kids at the March for Life. So I think they had wanted to get way out ahead in ahead of it. And it turned out that wasn't necessary because the behavior wasn't necessary of condemnation. So a lot of them did reverse course and you know, admit to jumping the gun for what I presume was that reason. Mm-hmm. And others in the media have as well, but by no means everyone. And the more time goes on, the more this everyone needs to slot this. You have to, you know, you're for Trump or you're anti-Trump. That's right. No one. That is the lens of everything. And so it has to be. And I was on Fox News talking about this, and President Trump tweeted referencing the segment I was on and tweeted about how they had been mistreated. And, you know, I'm a libertarian. I have lots of criticisms of the president. Mm-hmm. I don't fit neatly into one box or the other. But I just try to I don't have no, whatever the truth is what I'm interested in. And the truth is these people were mistreated, and everyone, including Trump, who says they were mistreated, is right. So I don't know what to do with that. It's just truth.
You know, I think what stood out, Robbie, in your piece was that there was so much polarized, divided, back and forth going on. Your piece came in and you're just calling it as you see it. Your language is measured. Your descriptions are objective. Someone could read this and not know where you stand relative to Trump, or relative to the March for Life, relative to Native American issues. And I think it was that objective flavor. Hey, a little sanity. This is so refreshing to get in the midst of all of the, I mean, I was on Twitter looking at things, and my goodness, the back and forth, it didn't stop. So I think it was almost a kind of journalistic recognition that people got from your piece. And it might have, you know, let Jake Tapper, I think I came to your piece through Jake Tapper, was, hey, this is what we're all supposed to be doing.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, as a professional journalist, I feel I'm glad I've contributed, you know, in a positive way to this conversation, and that it was well received by many people. But what is so frustrating now in the last day of this, as this news cycle enters, I don't know, whatever it is, day five, there is now an effort. So people who will not admit they were wrong and that they mischaracterized this must find some other evidence beyond the videos to say, well, these boys are bad, they're evil, so we were right. So now there is this elaborate effort to comb social media or details about the school or other things that they may have done wrong, which, spoiler alert, of course there's something they did wrong somewhere. They're teenagers. If you had a camera following you at all times, I mean, I would look bad, you would look bad, every person on planet Earth has looked bad at a moment in their lives. I don't understand why any additional details confirming that they are indeed human would change the underlying. That would not change the fact that they did not engage in targeted racial harassment of Nathan Phillips. On the contrary, he misled the media about what was going on, entering a moment that he had no reason to disrupt in that way. So there is no new data that can emerge, unless it's within the videos, that can change that reality. And yet I just saw a news article, I think it was NBC or ABC, I think it was NBC, but that interview with a previous like valedictorian,
right,
in Covington, who was not allowed to give his speech or something, and that's supposed to matter. Why? And then I had just stopped at home briefly, and my wife pointed out, she goes, did you realize it's not even the same high school? It's just it's a different school in that diocese, but it's not the same high school even.
Right, and I mean, because this kid is gay, right? Wasn't that the issue? This was homophobia.
Yeah, or maybe he just didn't turn his speech in on time. I mean, I don't know. Who cares? What does this have to do with anything?
Well, I read that, Robbie, and I saw. So wait, they're not going to. They refuse to let the valedictorian speak because he's gay. And I'm thinking, but wait a minute. If there's an anti-gay animus, how did he ever get such top grades and beat out everyone else for years? He's compiled the best record of this. I mean, come on.
And if this is supposed to establish that, like, the Covington kids are anti-gay or something, again, that's undermined by the content of the video footage, which has them booing the deranged cult when they shout homophobic things about the boys and about, they say, Trump, your president is a homosexual, and the kids say, who cares?
Yeah,
in response.
Yeah.
So now it's just dumb.
you know, there. This is an episode, media jumping the guns, partisan passions overwhelm journalistic objectivity. Now, we've seen those kinds of episodes happen before. Do you think that this one stands out in some ways? Do you think that this really crosses over even the other times when the line has been crossed? This one's really different. There's something that feels different about this one.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it's been going for so many days now and doesn't really show signs of slowing. I think this is a once every couple of years sort of thing. Actually, what it reminds me strongly of, and I think I've mentioned this on social media, maybe in one of my pieces, this reminds me a lot of the Rolling Stone UVA gang sexual assault hoax from 2014.
I should say you were an important figure in bringing out the truth of what was going on there.
I wrote an early skeptical take of the story, which was, and that ended up being previously one of my biggest kind of stories. And then I was very kind of closely monitoring the fallout from that. And that was, like this, I think that was a story that broke a lot of people's faith in a sort of previously credible mainstream news outlet. Mm-hmm. And it was also, but you know, the thing about that story is, at once it was revealed by Jackie, the alleged victim, her friends came forward and said, you know, the person she's accusing doesn't exist and in fact is her because she's been catfishing us and sending us fake texts from this person. You know, there was a mm-hmm. so no one could deny that it was not made up at that point. Mm-hmm. This was OK. It is a hoax. You have to admit that. I feel like we've just had that moment for this story when we've right. seen when you saw the extended video footage. And yet everyone is reacting, but there's still a significant number of prominent people saying right. they don't believe it. I almost think if the UVA story had come out now in our more highly politicized news and culture and politics environment in the post Me Too and right. with Me Too kind of, I bet even when the kids had said, obviously this is a catfish scenario, you would have had deniers the way we have deniers right now about Covington.
I've noticed some people. Kirsten Powers is,
oh
still,
my God.
Is still holding on to this, and it's. I mean, what some people look, you forgot. These are 15 and 16-year-old kids. Right. I mean, these are minors.
And I don't believe in infantilizing children, and right, we should right. inspire them to better. And you know, if there had been no news story about this, I would say I hope when they get back to the school, everybody who went on the field trip sits down in the gym with the principal and chaperones, and they could just have a conversation about how things went down and could talk about what they might do differently next time. And I think that would be perfectly reasonable thing to do, and it could be constructive because young people, young men are you know, in need of some guidance to become better and more complete and more responsible human beings. But that's so different from, oh my God, dox them, harass them, threaten them because they're racists. Yeah. It's just astonishing.
How does the book, well, we'll turn to the book now, The Panic Attack, Young Radicals in the Age of Trump, has that prepared you to look at this episode with particularly perceptive eyes?
Sure. So I spend a lot of time for the book, you know, speaking with young people. So the subject is these kinds of young activist movements that are particularly on college campuses, but also in the streets of D.C. and New York and Berkeley and Portland that have arisen over the last few years. Many people have noticed kind of the new questions of free speech and due process that are oftentimes threatened by this kind of, you know, Gen Z political activism, whereas in previous decades it was a very ACLU positive activism where free speech was seen as very important to the activists. Actually, mm-hmm. I have a story in my book about how the craziest left-wing group at Berkeley in the 60s invited a Nazi to speak just to make a free speech point. And nobody heckled him or tried to shut him down. They just laughed at him. And when he was done, he went on his way. And that was, you know, 20 years after Nazis were actually a thing. Mm-hmm. Now, if you tried to do that, I mean, they would shut down campus. There would be a day of mourning. People would be expelled because of how things have changed. So I explored where these students kind of get their ideas from and what is influencing them to kind of adopt this new mode of activism and what the goals are of these various kinds of resistance era political movements, Me Too and Black Lives Matter and Parkland Kids and so on.
How much did they acknowledge or imply that their outlook came from their professors or their high school teachers?
So that's a very interesting question. The answer is not a lot. Mm-hmm. And I have come to think that the idea that many conservatives seem to have that it's their left-wing professors are indoctrinating them and that's the problem, is not as compelling as many conservatives may think. Mm-hmm. It seems to me a lot of these kids get to campus. And again, we're talking about a small number of young people. I'm talking about the activists who are out there shutting people down. Mm-hmm. Most students on campus are not like this. They're there to learn.
Right.
And they would like to hear an interesting speaker. Now, they're afraid to do anything when
they keep their heads down.
That's right. So I'm talking about a small radical subset. But I think a lot of those people almost get to campus already in a certain mindset, and maybe they're supplied the language of their activism by their professors. And again, it's by a small number of professors in specific disciplines, in sociology, in critical race theory, in these kinds of activist departments that actually are not particularly scholarly rigorous and are sort of teaching, are not teaching any theory really. They're instructing in the practice of activism.
And they actually have very small, a pretty small enrollment. I mean, women's studies collects less than 1 out of 1,000 students major in women's studies. I mean, I think it's about maybe 1 out of 2,000 students major in women's studies.
But these students spread their ideas to each other. And in the internet age, in the age of social media, I mean, it's easy to connect with what the Antifa group in Texas is doing or in Portland or what the Black Lives Matter chapter of California did. Or, I mean, they're in Facebook groups. They're tweeting at each other. I think there's a community of activism that is more connected because it's very easy for them to learn from each other and talk to each other. And it's in their dorms. It's in their kind of the administrator kind of area of campus. It's not they're fine and then they sit down at a desk and then they're preached at and then they're radicalized. I don't think that's what happens.
You know, I tend to agree just in many ways because there's so much disengagement between students and professors at universities. When you look at the numbers, how often they go to office hours and talk to teachers outside of class, it's pretty dim. But I think it'd be a fascinating social psychological experiment or study to take a group of activists who marched on the president's office about some episode that happened to look at their social media in the 5 hours before they did their march, just to see how the messages went back and forth. How did the planning or the emotion, how did that build? I think that would be highly illuminating.
I've seen that they'll share. You can share posts from Facebook pages, featuring an activist of yore with a quote of that person. And it's like that's how they're learning about, you know, Stokely Carmichael or Angela Davis or Dworkin or one of the second wave feminist figures. That's how it's being learned about and kept alive.
And when you look at this as the age of Trump, the Black Lives Matter protests, they were 2015, they were actually 2014-15?
Right.
Which was before Trump really materialized, correct?
Yes, yeah.
But then as soon as, was there a big change in the student protests when we hit the age of Trump?
Yeah, I would say so. And you know, I'm somewhat sympathetic to some of these protest movements because you know I'm a libertarian. I am interested in criminal justice reform, and I think there has been some bad police behavior. Some of the incident, not all of them, but some of the ones that Black Lives Matter point to, like the Tamir Rice and the man on the streets of New York. I can't think of his name. At the Eric Garner, I think that was his name. You know, some of these I thought were just as obvious examples of injustice as the Black Lives Matter people did as well.
Yeah.
The frustrating thing, I think it's become more and obviously the movement was from the get-go focused on the harm to Black people because of overcriminalization or police issues. But everything has gotten so much more explicitly racial. Our politics is more explicitly framed around race. As a reaction to and because of and in part because Trump kind of likes it that way too, which means it's harder to form coalitions, I think, around certain issues. I mean, you know, if I'm trying to convince an older white conservative man that he should support, you know, decriminalizing marijuana or something, or mandatory minimum, or getting rid of mandatory minimum sentencing, I'm not going to frame it in this like stark racial terms, like, you know, this is how you all privileged white people are enslaving Black people. I'm going to say, you know, these programs are too expensive and they don't work, and we can't even keep drugs out of prison, for goodness sake. You know, to have a coalition around an issue requires not going to some of those identity corners. But the activist left increasingly every day, and the activist right as well, love to see it in terms of identity.
When you talk to the student activists, did you have to get around? Did you feel you had to get around your identity?
I mean, absolutely.
White male.
Right.
You're married with kids. You know, right. If I don't, you know, I don't want to probe here. So.
No. And I'm north of 30 now. I mean, I donned a Michigan T-shirt or something when I walked around that campus. I think I can pass for a student to some degree still. Maybe not anymore, but this is probably the last time I'll ever be able to do that. Uh-huh. But many of the activists themselves are white as well. I'd say this is by no means just, you know, it's just this is the problem of Black kids or something. It's not at all that. There are white kids who have these attitudes as well. You know, they were not easy. Many of the people I tried to talk to had no interest in talking to me when I identified myself as a member of the media. It is for how much is made of kind of Trump and Trump's coalition's dislike of the media. The activist left has the same disdain and then some. Actually, we're seeing that a little bit now with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calling, she called like the Washington Post that accused them of like fake news or something. Not in those exact words, but she's been accused that they're misrepresenting her. The left, the activist left is hugely distrustful of the media. They think their stories should only be told by activist publications. Mm-hmm. So the activist newspaper or the extremely progressive news site, and everyone else they're very skeptical of.
Let me ask you one final question. Why do you call it Panic Attack, your book?
The idea is that the absolute freak out over Trump and what he represents has stopped us from being able to have a healthy and rational conversation about all the ways in which he is wrong, and I'm talking about on the left. Mm-hmm. And instead it is driven by emotion and panic. It's a literal panic attack that is counterproductive to the cause of thwarting some of his policy aims that I would actually like to see thwarted.
And the book contains many episodes.
It's a chronicle of infighting on the left, produced by their adherence to various some of their philosophies that put them in tension with each other. And no better example of this than their inability to say anything bad about the Black Hebrew Israelites, who are a homophobic group, but a Black identity group, and that tension, that contradiction. Just they have no idea how to reconcile, and so they have to not say anything about it, and instead, you know, fixate on the injustice done to this Native American man who was there in bad faith.
Right. Okay. Panic Attack, Young Radicals in the Age of Trump, which you can go get on Amazon. Robbie, thank you. That was great.
My pleasure. Thank you.